Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Sarah Pascoe.
Hello, I'm Carrie Adloyd.
And we're weird about books.
We love to read.
We read too much.
We talk too much.
About the too much that we've read.
Which is why we've created
the Weirdos Book Club.
Join us!
A space for the lonely outsider to feel accepted and appreciated.
A place for the person who'd love to be in a real book club but doesn't like wine or nibbles.
Or being around other people.
Is that you? Join us.
Check out our Instagram at Sarah and Carrie Ads Weirdos Book Club for the upcoming books we're going to be discussing.
You can read along
and share your opinions.
Or just skulk around in your raincoat like the weirdo you are.
Thank you for reading with us. We like reading with you. This week's book guest is Bluets
by Maggie Nelson.
What's it about? It's a collection of short suppositions on the colour blue.
What qualifies it for the Weirdos Book Club? Well, it's a book about blue.
In this episode, we discuss poetry.
Lapis lazuli.
Gouging.
Inspiration.
Joni Mitchell.
Goethe.
Pain.
Love letters.
And Ricky Gervais.
And joining us this week is Katie Wicks. Katie is an actor and writer, and you'll know her from Staff Let's Flat and Ghosts, and the author of the incredible memoir, Delicacy.
Trigger warning, heartbreak and suicide. Welcome, Katie Wicks, and your apple.
Yeah.
Some guests just bring their book.
Just that shot.
You bought yourself an apple.
An apple for teacher.
It's a real power move. If we're making a point that you don't agree with, just like.
Really early on when I did the podcast, when they were still quite new, I was eating a carrot. I was really, really hungry. I was eating a carrot throughout. Mm. I had so many complaints. It was really tense. It was horrible. I really learnt my lesson.
So, Katie, we're very excited to have you. And you have chosen this week. We don't always let our guests choose.
We don't know. It's very rare that our guests choose.
It's by Maggie Nelson. And how are we saying it?
Bluets.
Well,
Bluets. She talks about getting it wrong.
Yes, exactly. That bit towards the end, because I assumed it was Bluets, but then I think she says technically it's Bluet.
I know, and I'm glad she tells me that at the end.
Yeah, I got that.
Bluets. Yeah, that's what I got from that. Yeah. But I mean, it was really fun to have to read it again. And even though it's short, yesterday I was like, oh, I've got an hour, I'll read this. Forgetting it's like the most dense thing. And it does, you can't read it an hour, even though it's 97 pages.
When did you
first read it?
Yeah, how did you discover this book? How did it find you?
That's quite a fun story because, well, not fun, but interesting for me. So when I got my book commissioned, I thought, well, I don't know how to write a book. This is going to be a disaster. So rather than start writing straight away, I spent about 6 months just reading and sort of trying to learn how to write. Because until that point, I didn't really know what I was doing. And I wanted to, you know, take it seriously and try and see if I could really work on craft and writing something that had some artistic value rather than just someone who's been on TV or in a book kind of thing. So I took it very seriously, and I have a really good mentor as well who's so smart and has read everything, who's so literary, that I would send those drafts to and get incredible notes. And so I felt like it was sort of a doubly incredible experience because it forced me to learn how to get better at writing and take it more seriously. But around about this time, do you know a writer called Matilda Winneck? She's in a double act as well called Beard.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I remember speaking to her, and she's one of the smartest people I've ever met. And I was in the Edinburgh Courtyard, and I said, oh, you know, I'm going to write this memoir, and I don't know what I'm doing, so I'm just reading loads of women's memoir in getting really inspired. And she said, well, obviously, you've read Megan Nelson, right? She was like, that's the first thing you do. And I was like, I don't know who that is. And then, so she wrote a memoir, Megan Nelson, called The Argonauts.
The Argonauts is the first one.
Which it's incredible. Yeah. So that was the first thing she said. She said, well, obviously, read that. So I read that, and it was kind of like a door opened in my head that I didn't even know there was a door there. It was like, wow, there's a whole other way to write
this. Yeah.
And to communicate. And actually, I do think this is true of your book as well, Katie, which is why it's so interesting going through this process. Yeah. But it feels like the person invented a way to write to communicate what they had to say, which could only be expressed that way.
There are
techniques in your book. I don't think Megan Nelson is very funny, which you are. Where's the jokes, Maggie? Yeah.
Do you know what? I did read one review and they picked up on this one bit and they were talking about how hilarious it was, and I was like, come on.
She's my
heroine, but she's not hilarious.
You're not watching her Edinburgh show.
Whereas you have some sort of joke format, really, in your book. That off the top of my head, I think of you texting your personal trainer.
Oh yeah.
And I love it because I love it when I see a joke format that I've never seen before, because the writer has invented it to tell a joke this way.
Oh, that's
With Maggie in a slightly more when I was reading it last night, I kept thinking of the word preposterous. It's actually preposterous how she writes.
Audacious.
Audacious. It's so far off the scale of audacious. I kept going, it's preposterous. She's written a book which is little segments,
sort of tiny poem vignettes.
And it really is about the colour blue. And then because it's about the colour blue, it's then about some other things.
Yeah. So after I read The Argonauts, this was the one I read next, which was even more helpful. And I stole this format from one of my chapters. And because I've obviously, I don't know if you do this, but when I love a writer, I go away and I'll read every interview with them and try and find out about their life and stuff like that. And I was listening to her on a podcast and she was talking about this series of propositions that she calls. So the book is like a series of numbered propositions, 1 to 250, I think. Mm. It's sort of like an homage to Wittgenstein, who writes in this way. So it's got this kind of scientific, philosophical argument there as well. So that's kind of part of the reason. But I guess I see them as like little poems as well.
Yeah, they feel like tiny stanzas of poems.
Yeah.
And she also said that she rearranged them in lots of different ways.
Yeah.
And almost you could read them in any order, or you could read them in this order.
Yeah. It really defies sort of description in a really lush way, in a way that really inspired me as well, because I thought, there's no way I can just plod along chronologically, then this happened. When I was going to write, I thought I'd be so bored, and I don't have the attention span and the confidence to think like massive structures. I have to break it down into little fragments. Lydia Davis was another huge inspiration to me, who writes like these micro stories, hundreds of them. So I kind of knew that really appealed to me. But
it's that thing about short books, which, we've had episodes about giant books, which, like you said, are epic, and it's a big yarn and a big story.
And I think
then you get a book like this that it can be easy to think that's easy to write that, or it's simple. But like you said, it's not a simple book at all, even though elevator pitch would be like, it's some poems about being in love with blue.
Yeah.
But it's so... it's doing a lot.
Oh yeah,
considering
it's so dense.
250 stanzas that are small,
and there's a lot of it I don't understand.
Yes,
I should say that straight
away,
in case anyone. And I always hope this with our podcast, that someone goes, "Oh, I'm going to get that book. It sounds really interesting."
Yeah.
And I'm fine with the fact there's so much I don't understand.
I think it requires a reread.
That's why I could admit it,
well,
Katie.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was my third read, and I was getting new stuff. It was like, it was a different book, actually.
Yeah,
it was
same.
Kind of spooky. I was like, wait, I've read that before?
Yeah.
And either it would make more sense or less sense or a different...
In the way that poems can affect you so differently.
Yeah.
Because my first read, and the classic, I read it off the back of reading Wifedom, which is about the wife of George Orwell, who was kind of written out of history. It's very factual, very raw, very angry, but very, the truth is very on the surface.
Yeah.
And then I came to this and I was like, she's not telling me anything.
Yeah, she's
What's
requiring
happening?
A lot from her reader.
And the reread.
And I am there for
this. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is very calm and peaceful. But when I read it before, I felt like I wasn't getting that.
Also, it's so sad.
It's incredibly sad.
And sadness does need quiet.
Yeah, I wasn't ready. I was
it's
on
not
adrenaline.
Trauma.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not drama. It's not violence.
Yeah.
It's and the sadness of it is indulgent sadness.
It's very indulgent. And yeah. you do have to kind of... Sometimes I loved her, and other times I was like, oh, fuck off, Maggie.
Yeah,
oh,
no, I loved it when there was occasion. I'd go, okay, I mean, I adore you, Maggie Nelson,
yeah.
and that's so pretentious what you just said.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know what, I know what you mean, but the same, one of the things I love about her is even with indulgence, it's like this precision of language and her mind and how learned she is.
Yeah.
And the mixture of this sort of, this rigour, you know, how intelligent she is,
yeah.
mixed with just bodily, sexual, crass.
Well, yeah, then suddenly she'll talk about everyday. Blue veiny cock.
Yeah,
yeah.
And,
yeah.
Really, and you go, that, oh, this is really, this yeah. isn't, it isn't pretentious because this yeah. is what your mind is thinking about in exactly the same way. You're not trying to shock me with a description of a penis and you're not trying to show off how clever you are. She talks a lot about philosophers like I also know what she knows and I don't.
But while interweaving...
Really high and low.
Yeah, because yeah. she's yeah. also talking about who I'm a massive fan of, Joni Mitchell, who obviously has an album, Blue, and that comes up a lot. And then she's talking about missing fucking this ex-boyfriend and people, the saints who claw out their eyes so that they can, their blue eyes.
Yeah.
The references that she throws in, it is high and low, but she does it in a very poetic way.
Totally. That's one of the things I love about it as well is, which she did in The Argonauts, that she shows you what she reads and how she got there. And that was really helpful. Like I always try and follow up some of the readers she mentions because I sort of want, I just want access to, you know, like her experience.
And also that's the only way to sort of know what she's telling you is to go, okay, if you're using two words, if you're saying that, I need to find out what both of those words mean.
Yeah.
So I know what you told me. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And even the way she talks about, you know, that she enjoys telling people that she's writing a book about the color blue. And trying to get funding for it and no one's interested and what a kind of bizarre idea it sounds.
I loved it when she described the satin bowerbird for
several.
And she's talking about this male satin bowerbird, which actually probably most of us have seen on like a, I want to say
Earth.
Daniel Attenborough, but that's not his name.
David. His brother Daniel was very funny.
On a David Attenborough show.
Successor.
And then she sort of says, maybe I'm a female satin bowerbird. And I was like, maybe you are though.
Yeah. She starts by saying, suppose I fell in love with a colour, is how it opens. So I like the fact that it's almost like, have I? You know, suppose.
Yeah.
And then so you have this whole incredibly like detailed exploration of the colour, but also like pain and divinity and heartbreak. And it's all about her heartbreak as well. And at the end, and the bit I think I quoted it in the book, I remember that I stole from my book. Right at the end, she undermines it all by sort of saying, I would rather have had you than any of this blue.
Yeah.
Which I really related to because my book was so much about loss. I stole it at the end to sort of say, well, the only reason I could write this book was because all these things happened to me that were kind of rich enough to write about. But I would rather have the people back and alive and there be no book.
Yeah.
And that's still the truth, even though it took like a year of my life to write. So
and it's
I really related to that. And
it
really undermined the whole point of the book in a really cool way that was like, I've written this whole book about this colour, but actually it's about a distraction from my heartbreak at the end.
I thought
that was really nice.
On the reread, that really stood out to me of that bit of just like the two sweetest experiences are like they're making love to you basically and not having that.
Prince of Blue.
And Prince of Blue. And I have written a book about grief and
I've
felt
more
that.
More than one. If the rumours to be believed.
And I had to write like an end note for the paperback and that's what I wrote in the end note of like, when you've written about a great loss, you feel privileged that you're allowed that chance to do it. And then when I'd sort of got it off my chest, so to speak, I looked around at other people my age and thought, oh, right, that's what I'd do if I didn't have all this shit to deal with. Like I looked at someone else doing something, like I had a break from comedy to go down this grief road and I was like, oh man. So if it hadn't happened, maybe I just stayed there making jokes about stuff, but my heart was full of pain. I couldn't do that. And so I felt that on that note she said, I was like, for all her intellectualizing and her references and her beauty, she is heartbroken.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, oh, yeah.
It's interesting you say that because I had a similar thing that when I was grieving that it was like, I definitely lost my sense of humour for about a year in a really stubborn, just in a way that was like, nope, you can't force me out of this. I don't find any of this funny.
Yeah, like it's not pointless. Like, it's so pointless.
I'm going to smile through it. It's like, I'm not interested in doing that. I'm interested in like really sitting in this, like wallowing in it in a really self-indulgent way till I'm ready.
I think it's hard when people know you for being funny or for being flippant about things.
Yeah.
And then they hit a wall with you and you're like, yeah, but not this. Like, yeah, I'm
it's
a human.
Like a weird
obviously,
projection, isn't it, that you always will have, understandably.
Both of you wrote books that had jokes in. Alongside, being bereft,
we can't help but be funny.
No, but so what's the relationship? Is that a conscious choice? Do you think it's a personality thing? I mean,
for me, it's very much I'm in control of that humor though. Like, so I'm making the jokes about it. What I find is acceptable, like the limits, and then I'm also able to be achingly sincere about my pain because it's my book. But I was also writing a book that was. A guidebook's not right, but it was like, Dad. I was writing a book that was about helping people get through this experience. Yeah. So I knew I needed to have humour in it so that it wouldn't be scary because I know that the way I view grief and talking about it is a bit intense for some people.
Yeah.
So the jokes for me were like, hey, don't worry. Mm. Once you get in here, I'm going to be really intense, but don't worry. I'm going to joke you in the room. Mm. That's what it was for me. Yeah. I know what your experience.
Well, I agree. I felt really self-conscious about suddenly trying to write very sincerely, really self-conscious about it after years of just trying, of doing the opposite,
silly,
throwing it always away. And I felt like it was a joke for someone and a serious bit for me.
Yeah,
because the bits I love to write the most were the not funny bits.
Yeah, I felt. The really heartfelt bits that made me cry typing.
Yeah, and those bits were creatively invigorating as well to be like, well, am I any good at actually doing real writing?
Yeah.
Like, what would happen if I did
that? I think that's very much... coming from comedy or when comedy is not easy for you but it's something that comes naturally, it's where you began,
feel safe
you always see the other stuff as real. So I felt like that when I had to write my book of like, well, that's proper writing, like an Edinburgh play is not proper, standing on stage with bad lipstick and a wig is not proper. Like, it's stupid. And so it definitely seemed to me like you slightly have to prove yourself, but it is a topic, grief, heartbreak, that requires that seriousness. But then one's personality, you know, if you are a comic or you have done that, there's always that irreverence to how you see the world slightly.
Yeah, you can't help but think of jokes as well when you can't help it.
Yeah.
Along the way, it just does it, doesn't it? If like, oh yes, I've just made that little connection. Oh yeah, I'll put that in because it's funny.
That's why car drives with comedians are so unbearable.
Yeah.
Because you've got four brains all doing that exact same thing.
Like, the Netflix series. Yeah.
Car drives with comedians.
Yeah. So bad, they made it into a TV show.
I pitched it first, it was just me crashing a car into a wall.
With everyone saying, this is not funny.
Me stopping at an Essa going, get out, until you can just look out the window without doing gags. I thought, because the linear nature of this book, and there is a linear story too, but.
Yeah, loose in there.
Yeah, but I wondered if we could just pick paragraphs and just discuss them.
Because
something that I thought was wonderful and. Very cleverly done.
Oh, I'm excited to hear.
Is this sort of side by side of the person you're in love with does something which makes you think that they're not the person you thought they are, which actually is about finding out who they actually are, and how that's exactly the same with colour, is that you don't know that anyone sees colour you see it.
Yeah.
And what does that mean?
Yeah.
And how much does it bother you? And so she has this quote about, like, just let the objects be the objects.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm paraphrasing. If he hadn't lied to you, he would have been a different person than he is. She's trying to get me to see that although I thought I loved this man very completely for exactly who he was, I was in fact blind to the man he actually was or is.
Oh, I found that bit really good. I was like, like, that's every woman in therapy.
Well, I think everyone who's ever loved anyone, actually. I think there's this, you fall in love, you're building a sense, and then there's this next phase, which is, letting go of the things you built or not, and then having the difficulty of...
And she very carefully, cleverly links that to Blue. So I've got one I marked. It's she's talking about Goethe. That's how you say it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Describes blue as a lively colour. It may be said to disturb rather than enliven. Is to be in love with blue then to be in love with a disturbance, or is the love itself the disturbance? And what kind of madness is it anyway to be in love with something constitutionally incapable of loving you back?
Yeah, I love
and
that.
And I was like, obviously that's a relationship, obviously that's the colour. Like to
all take that, fam.
There's that really funny bit as well where she says, in fact, this is a genuinely funny bit, it made me laugh, when she talks about whether blue could keep you company and whether it could love you back. She sees something blue and it's like, oh, here we are again. And it's like it winks back at you.
Yeah.
It just acknowledges your presence, keeping you company. There's also the bit that over the page from that the quote you read out about falling in love with someone who you didn't know. I like the way she kind of collapses therapy language.
Mm.
And I liked all that stuff about therapy and how she and how horrible she is about self-help.
Yes,
she talks like too simplistic language or something like that.
She describes picking up the way deepest love is blue, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Realising it's really about women in therapy, throwing it back on shelf and then ordering it 6 months later. She's like, actually,
I love this quote that she says, psychology forces everything we call love into the pathological or the delusional or the biologically explicable. If what I was feeling wasn't love, then I'm forced to admit that I don't know what love is, or more simply that I loved a bad man. I also really love the bit about what the ancient philosophers thought that how our eyes worked.
Yes, yeah.
And that Pythagoras thinks it's that there must be something coming from our eyes that illuminates objects.
Yeah.
And then what's his face? I can't remember, the philosopher says, no, well, that doesn't work because what happens at night then?
Yeah.
And then someone else
stops existing.
Yeah, and then someone else says, oh, I think it's something in between, that there's a fire in between us and the object that illuminates both. That was really fascinating.
When she's talking as well about, like, we see a poppy going, a bee flying towards an orange poppy, but to a bee it looks like a violet mouth. And again, just being like, then who is... like, who is right? What are we observing? Which, again, you can just instantly reflect back to love and what one person sees in a relationship, the other person sees. The bit that broke my heart at the end where she writes to the Prince of Blue and she says, you kept my last letter.
He didn't open it.
Yeah, he didn't open it, as if it was a talisman. But I actually just wanted you to know what I thought.
Know.
And I was like, oh, that is...
I had something to say to you and I needed you to hear.
Yeah, I thought that was strange to be okay with that he didn't want to know. Her thoughts.
Do you think I felt like she wasn't okay? Yeah, I felt like she was like,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. Let's let the listener decide.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I love her use of Joni Mitchell, I have to say. And there's a paragraph where she talks about how Joni and Billie Holiday as well have lost their talent, you know, because their voices
their
don't sound the same.
Ravaged.
And she says, one reviewer recently wrote, Mitchell's voice is a husky shadow of its former feather-like glory, mirroring how her joyful, playful attitude has dwindled to bitter dissatisfaction. And I feel like she doesn't even have to say to the reader, that's not fucking true. As if late Joni is not as heart-wrenching and beautiful as Blue is, but that someone has lived and changed. And I thought that's incredible in one paragraph to quote someone else and leave a gap, but we know exactly what she's saying.
That's
how can
so
you criticise a woman for ageing and changing?
Yeah.
Because she doesn't sound light anymore. And therefore you assume she's bitter rather than she's lived.
The parallel with the Goethe Young Werther book, which she mentions towards the end, because the parallel is how we romanticise other people's pain. Like the reason people love Joni Mitchell and Billie Holiday so much is the pain in their voices.
Yeah.
They're not poppy, bright singers.
No.
Those qualities described, even though the language sounds negative, it would be if you were describing a woman's face.
It's interesting because what it requires is that a woman must be shiny and happy, because early Joni isn't shiny and happy, but her voice is, she hasn't smoked 20 cigarettes a day.
Yeah.
And Joni famously recorded I've Looked at Life from Both Sides Now.
Yes.
As a young woman, which is quite poppy. Mm. And then there's a much older version, which is like, I've looked at life. Yes, and it's hot, and it's a much more poignant song, and it's much more beautiful.
I can imagine.
But again, it's like for a reviewer to say.
I thought that review was supposed to be, I thought it was a positive review.
No, they're saying it. I read it like they're saying it's a husky shadow. I guess you could say probably.
I think it is positive.
Well, nicotine-ravaged vocals, I guess, of the once angelic, now gasping Joni Mitchell.
But it's better. It's like saying this wine is really old.
Yeah.
So this whole book about blue, about sadness and being brokenhearted and young Werther, and she doesn't go too much into it, but it's a really, really sad book about this young man, and he falls in love with this woman, and she's betrothed to be married to someone else, and he tries to be richer and he befriends her, but he has no money, so she's never going to marry him. But they do become friends, and then she does marry the rich guy, and he drowns himself.
And, cheery book.
Well, the thing was that it was published and everyone was like, he's the most romantic guy ever. And rather than thinking, what a sad story.
It really spawned
and they
romanticism,
made statues of him and wore cravats aimed to be like him.
And then she says a lot of copycat.
Yes.
Suicide.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was seen as the most, that's what you do for love. You break yourself, you undo
being
yourself.
Being in love with death for romantic gesture.
Whereas her last few lines, she does show you another option. I think that's what's beautiful about the ending. It's that even though the reality is, you know, love, you would sacrifice so much pleasurable things.
Do you think she's okay at the end?
Yeah, do you know what? I think with her writing, I sometimes think there's at times, because I wonder how who the I is sometimes of the book.
Yeah.
Because she sort of talks about, you know, these have been rearranged so many times. They've been so, when I'm reading it, I can forget that they've been curated so that, you know, you do go on a particular journey and you do sort of learn something at the end, and the effect it has on the reader. I feel like she's so aware of that, and she's so sort of technically amazing. And I sometimes think even if there's a performativity to her pain, it's still pain.
Yeah.
It's still real. Because I'm so aware when I was writing my book that there was like a performativity to the pain sometimes. In the way that sometimes when you see someone on Facebook say, oh, I guess I've just had a really shitty day, guys. And, you know, it's sort of that awful, painful thing where you just know they're trying to get connection and attention. And there's something so awful about witnessing it.
Yeah,
but really relatable. Like, I wish I had the guts to just say that online. What's the worst thing that would happen?
Well, also,
I never could.
If you were feeling that much pain, you wouldn't be able to write the Facebook status.
Yeah, it's really performative.
You do have to sort of get yourself back there.
But I think it's also someone being openly vulnerable, which I think people in comedy sometimes find hard.
Yeah.
Because I think you're right. Like, you see it and you laugh. You're like, oh my God, bloody hell. Yeah, like, calm down. And then you're saying, I couldn't write. I wouldn't be brave enough to write that.
And
I wouldn't be brave
to
say I want help. I'd have
to
hide it.
But also, it feels sad that in that moment you couldn't have said that to a real person.
Yeah,
it feels
slightly
heartbreaking to me.
Yeah.
But I get that maybe that's, you know, that's a judgment in of itself.
And it's a judgment in that if you spot it, you got it thing.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Whose job requires attention.
Absolutely.
So our first thing is to go, oh, needed a bit of attention.
Yeah.
As I'm on the way up to my gig.
Yeah. One of the things that I also feel like I borrowed a bit when I was writing, there's a really great bit, because you know the friend who has the awful,
yes, of course, the paraplegic
accident.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I did read one review that's sort of questioning, I don't know, the sort of ethics of how she'd sort of taken that and then reframed it.
Oh, yes, and what it says about her.
Yeah.
Her friend's pain. But she seems in such admiration.
Totally, yeah. And that was all amazing, that stuff about, at one point where she's described as being like a pebble in water, that will stay with me forever. Mm. But she's talking about, and I sort of really referenced it when I was talking about caring for my mum towards the end, and because she was paralysed towards the end. There's a really similar bit where she talks about trying to move her body but
in
then
the
hurting
agony,
her.
Yeah.
And that just really kind of stung when I read it, that when caring for someone, you sort of accidentally cause them pain. And the whole thing that, you know, pain is like the way we see colour. It's so private. Mm. It doesn't go beyond your body. And when she talks about going to hospital and someone saying, describe the pain in terms of numbers.
Yes, yes.
And there's another incredible book, which I think you both love, you haven't read, called The Undying by Anne Boyer, who's an American poet, who's also incredible, who I read a lot before I was writing. And she's invented a new scale of pain based on Emily Dickinson poems that she says instead of a number.
That's incredible.
You're right, absolutely. We can't feel each other's pain.
Yeah.
It's virtually impossible to describe it. It's complete. And then certain people, it's diminished. We know that, you know, women of colour are never believed by pain.
Yeah.
And like Maggie Nelson says in this book, men always say 11.
Their own pain. And she's being glib. And the doctor says, women underestimate.
Yeah, so you say it's 6, it's going to be 8 then.
Women underestimate their own pain, I'll put you down as an 8. Yeah, and exactly, in the fact that, like you say, like people of colour, that doctors were sort of taught until about 20 years ago that
they didn't feel as much pain.
I thought that was interesting when she was talking about the friend and how her feet start turning blue because she's not using them. And they both observe them because now for the friend can't feel them. And so they're both at that point able to observe a piece of her friend's body that was once her personal body.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very beautiful, is not the right word, but just kind of like true friendship captured of like, but she's bearing witness with this person.
Things can be breathtaking in a way that you would normally think that's a response saved for beauty.
Yeah. It's a very beautiful book. It deals with a lot of beauty. And sometimes I found it cold because of that, because it was so, the language was so beautiful and what she's talking about comes so
it's
elevated,
contained as well,
that sometimes I would feel like, oh god, it's, I don't know, like it almost like she's talking about lapis lazuli, isn't it, like you can it is like a
it's
stone,
so
she's talking
academic
about.
Isn't it, at times?
Yeah,
it's so precise.
And do you know what I thought about the man, the Prince of Blue, you don't, at the end I was like, I only know that she really liked fucking him. You don't know a lot about
and
him.
And then he has but he's got another girlfriend.
Oh, you know, he's got another girlfriend, and she really liked fucking him a lot. And that's
six
kind
hours.
Of, six
yeah,
hours.
6 hours. There's that bit that
what
she
did you do for
about,
I was thinking 6 hours. You've only got 250 things about Blue.
I was thinking that, like, does that include like loo breaks?
Yeah, it must do. It must do. You can't just constantly. It must be a bit of a chat, get a pizza, start again.
Yeah, you get angry. But it's really interesting. I agree with that he's so sort of absent.
He's so absent,
in a way. But then she has that bit as well where she says that when you write about something, it alters the memory.
Or
the memory is sort of replaced with the thing you wrote.
Like when you see a childhood photo, then that's what you remember,
so
the photo.
A bit where she almost says, I don't want to write, I don't want to describe this too much because will change it, which I also really get.
Yeah, I definitely had that. Again, as someone who's written about their own life, that writing it down becomes the true version of it.
Yeah, the time capsule for it.
And then that's only your perception of it. You know, your family members read it and go, well, I don't remember that.
But that does happen to memory anyway, even without writing.
But writers have a sort of privilege of being the ones to put it down on paper go, this is what happened. Mm-hmm. And obviously, like, we don't have the Prince of Blues take on this situation.
I do. God, it's High Fidelity by Nick Hornby.
good. The follower.
Katie, I wanted to ask about that review, actually, because you said you read a review of this book. And I would never read reviews of books because I wouldn't want this podcast aside anyone else's opinion.
Oh, I always read reviews. I always quote
people
from here.
Even if reviews are not of me, I still find the act of reviewing so upsetting.
I find it interesting.
Why do they need to criticise everything? So you read a review of this book, and what did it say about the relationship with the pain of her?
There's a particular paragraph where it's about how the friend still manages to find a way to write because she was a writer before the accident, and that she still found a way to write, and that she wants to talk about the reality of the pain. And then the paragraph, so it's a bit quoted from the friend, and then Maggie ends it with something that she sort of reframes it, and I think this review is saying less, more of the
actual
the
voice,
writer, and less you reframing it, because she's sort of says that she doesn't want to be taken out of context. I think it was something like that. But I don't want Maggie to hate me. I would never say anything.
But isn't it not
Maggie.
Dedicated to her friend? Like it says at the end, first and forever, Princess of Blue, right at the end, dedication. And I was like, I feel like that is the friend.
Oh, really? I thought it was her daughter.
I assumed that was the friend.
I thought it wasn't problematic. I felt like it was so sort of sensitively done.
She's very much taking the point of view of my friend has had an accident. This is how I feel as a friend. She's not taking the view of my friend should feel this or she does. It's very much like trying, like you said, as a carer, as someone who sits with someone in pain, this is how I feel, which I, having read a lot of grief stuff, really appreciated, because I was like, it's so often it is about the person who's dealing with the epicenter of pain, whereas actually there are all these other people who are trying to help, like you said, literally move someone and they're screaming.
Yeah, different experiences, and hearing about your one.
Yeah, I felt like she was telling us.
And that's the validity, isn't it?
There's a great bit where she says that the friend who takes on this sort of oracle-like status, partly because you have to go to
them, literally go to the same place to see her.
Cool, but also that the friend doesn't buy into a sort of hierarchy of pain and suffering.
So
she wants to hear about, you know, Maggie rushing in and saying the Prince of Blues in love with another woman or whatever. And then that incredible bit at the end where she sort of, it's something like she doesn't know if the pain has meaning or if she believes in the soul, but she's seen the bright pith of her soul.
Yes, the bright pith of her soul.
Being so close to someone in unimaginable pain. It is romanticising in a way, isn't it? Because it's implying there's something sort of almost transcendent and martyr-like about...
It's really complicated, and there is a lot of stuff written about, like, you know, just because something terrible happened to you doesn't mean you are therefore a glorious person.
But
at the same time...
Everything has a meaning, kind of.
There is a meaning to staying present with someone in a hugely traumatic situation, and that's what I feel like I'm getting from Maggie.
It's a really, really unique human experience that most people wouldn't choose to have.
Like,
you wouldn't choose someone that you care about or love to be in, you know.
And she quite clearly has stayed with the friend, and a bit like she says, it's her friend's lover and her who seem to be helping her deal with this situation. She's obviously in the immediate circle. And I think that, you know, that is a carer's point of view. That's worthwhile. It's interesting. She's not saying my friend feels this. She's saying
She's not talking on behalf of someone.
No, she's saying this is how it feels to watch someone you love in agony lose their life, lose everything. And she is slightly comparing it to her own heartbreak, but only in a very artistic way of like, oh, I see loss everywhere.
And having had only like some experience of being a carer, like to get a glimpse, you know, to be in that world however long it was, you know, a couple of months when I was doing different caring for both my parents different times, like you realise there's this whole sort of quiet world of people caring, getting ill, you know, from the stress of it, absorbing it, being there. And I think of it as such a sort of strange few months of my life where I just had a backpack and was walking up and down hospital corridors constantly, like constantly crying, constantly sort of buying hummus from M&S. And, you know, it's just like a mad blur and just wearing comfortable shoes and sort of no makeup.
And it's like you become, there's a loss of self.
And you're just kind of thrown into it suddenly with no warning and cancelling everything. And oh, sorry, my life, and I indefinitely will be doing this now. Sorry. You know, I can't really do anything else.
And the medicalisation, suddenly you're expected to understand milligrams and when things should be dosed. And, you know, when you, the day before, you had no fucking idea. And people will hand you really hardcore medication, like, this needs to be done at this time, this needs to be this. And you're expected to understand it and not burst into tears and go, no, thank you, I don't want this life.
Because feeling like such an arsehole, because suddenly you're in hospital or whatever it may be, you know, around just like constant suffering and thinking, I can't believe, you know, like, a few months ago, I was just worrying about, you know, should I buy a new skirt? For me, it's like insane. When you're suddenly like, oh my God, this is real life. This is what real life is. I'm so embarrassed.
I think that's what she gets in this book, that it's a very unexpected accident. And I slightly feel like that's what I mean about artistic, the comparison is she's not saying, oh, my heartbreak is worthless compared to my friend is now a paraplegic. But she is saying, oh, there's all this pain and all this loss that we feel as humans, and isn't it? And I'm just looking at it.
She's acknowledging there is a hierarchy, and that some people would be hierarchical, but her friend isn't. I think so. I think she actually manages to sidestep and do both things.
Can I raise one thing that absolutely stopped me in my tracks?
Yes. It wasn't the purple veiny cock.
No, it wasn't. Going into every orifice. No, it was the phrase. In England, they say the blue hour is happy hour at the pub.
Oh, I know, I did underline that.
And
come
I was
on
like,
now.
I've never... Have you guys ever
it's
heard...
Not, it's not a phrase.
I thought they said in Germany.
No, she says in Germany, Blausein. In Germany, Blausein means to be drunk.
So I feel like what's happened is some English person...
Yes, has
maybe
told
Maybe someone
her.
With like an English parent at the university.
I read that.
Oh, yes, the blue, like in Germany. Yeah, blue hour, happy hour, 6 till 7.
It stopped me in my tracks. So I was, you know, you're so... But I was like, oh, Maggie, someone's lied to you. We don't call
someone's
happy hour
to
blue hour.
I didn't notice that. No, what? It's interesting because it's never been published before in the UK until really recently.
Oh, there you go.
Feeling it was Olivia Lang that championed her to be published in the UK. I think that's right. great.
Olivia should have told her.
Oh yeah, in England, the blue hour.
Happy hour at the pub.
That's so funny. The other bit that I really liked was, you know, when she talks about that book, is Isabel Eberhard, which I which I read because of this. She dresses a man to travel, hung out with some Sufis. Anyway, I read her book. You know a bit of her.
I really
the
want
Oblivion
to read it,
Seekers.
She says it's
amazing.
Like the most,
oh, the goes to hang out with the blue people, the Tuaregs. Yes.
The scraps of her travel diaries were found and published. The Oblivion Seekers. It's amazing. I really loved it. There's a really nice quote from Juliet Stevenson on the front.
Oh, nice.
And then
who plays Sarah's mum in her sitcom?
Oh yeah, of course. And then I bumped into her. We can pass this on for me. I saw her in the toilet at an award ceremony, and I just listened to her doing the voice of Wuthering Heights.
Oh yeah.
Which she voiced in an
audiobook. She's known as the audiobook
of.
Queen.
She was amazing at it because I listened to it in lockdown. But also, I wanted to go up to her and say, oh, you gave a quote for that really obscure book. Yes. I thought no one in the world has ever said this to her. Like, I love that book too. And I chickened out.
Oh, she would have loved it. Yeah.
I wish I'd done it.
She would have loved it.
Because I reckon about 20 people have bought that book in the last 10 years.
Sarah can text her.
It's just
I want to read it because it's great. If you have the page, what's the description that makes you want to read it? Because it's almost like the most extraordinary. Oh, here I've got it. The Oblivion Seekers, a collection one critic has described as one of the strangest human documents that a woman has given to the world. How could you not want to read that?
I think there's been stranger since, but I'm sure at the time.
I was going to ask you both, actually. Maggie Nelson has managed to write, you know, 250 questions, poems about
suppositions.
Blue. Suppositions, black blue. If you were going to do it, what would it be? What would the thing be? Because mine would be
take that.
And no, clothes of animals on them. Oh. I reckon clothes of animals on them. I could mostly knitwear, but in the permutations of it, I feel like I could do 250. Oh. And it would be seeing ducklings on little girls' tights.
You made me think about tights. I haven't thought about since I was. Eight, you know those white tights, and on the ankle there'd be like a dog with one diamante stud above it.
Our school uniform was white tights, and the boys used to like run and jump in a muddy puddle next to you, so that your white tights would get ruined.
Even then, ruining.
The sad girls would have woolly ones, and I don't know which shop, but the cool girls would have, who'd had sex early, would have like really thin white tights.
Like 20 denier.
20 denier sheer white.
And I was always like, where'd you get those from? I always imagine it'd be like, you lose your virginity.
You suddenly
find the thinner tights. Yeah. Is what I always imagine. When you start your period, you get the thin tights.
Yeah, the boys. When you buy your first packet of condoms,
they slide you the tight
cigarette. Yeah.
This is for the lady. This is for you. I don't know. Do you know, Katie?
Funny you say that because one of the ideas I've had if I was going to write another book would be really inspired by this because I love my dream is researching something and hours of rabbit holes. Oh my God, I love it so much. So part of me really, I mean, I couldn't write anything as good as this, but I love the idea of doing that anyway. I've thought about that. I mean, this feels like a really vulnerable thing to say. So my therapist is always telling me that I'm completely body dysmorphic and saying mad things that don't make sense all the time. And I sort of decided that most women kind of are on the spectrum. So I would love to, I mean, I feel like maybe it's done as a subject, but I would love to write about beauty and
I'd love to read what you wrote about beauty and dysmorphia.
I just think it's such a huge subject, you know.
Yeah.
And it's weird, like I had a conversation with Susie Orbach about this.
I saw that interview. It's brilliant. Wow. It was absolutely amazing.
I'm so terrified. But she said,
no, you were brilliant.
I think it was before the interview. She said, oh, it's got worse. It's got worse for women. You know, everyone thinks it's got better. I think it's got worse. And I still feel quite mixed about it because in some ways I mean, this is quite off topic. I see, I don't know. I suppose I see kind of body politics like I've never, like, that was never around when I was young. But then I also sort of see,
I think both things are true, aren't they?
That when we see women who haven't had work done, it's like really weird now on TV and stuff like that. So
there's a lot more information.
And there's lots of people saying positive things while still thinking negative thoughts and making negative decisions.
Yeah.
The way that women are expected to look a certain way, but would still have corrective surgery.
Yeah.
And not talk about it.
I feel like a hypocrite. Yeah. But also, like, in some ways, I think it's so radical to meet a woman who likes their body. I want to be that. I want to be that woman all the time, but I also know that that's not completely true. So I also want to be honest about the fact
but it's
not
it's
true.
incredibly you know I mean? Rare, and it was and it's another
so
thing
that it women feel like they're failing. One person at. I know.
No, yeah, well,
one person, yeah. A friend who
and
who
I bet
says
you could you could drill down and find, yeah, something. I know what you mean. I feel like I've got one friend, and
well, I had one friend, and then she had a baby, and now she isn't anymore.
Well, I was, yeah, going to say my one friend isn't straight, which I think might have something to do with it.
Oh yeah, that's interesting.
I think,
yeah,
it's hard as child of the '90s. I can understand. I totally understand why Susie Orbach would say that. But as child, yeah, of the '90s, when we're starting to unpick what we grew up with, that you are like, oh, I think it was a there was it was hideous that we were. Bridget Jones was fat. We were told,
yeah,
she was,
oh,
fat.
Oh my God, yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, she put on weight for that role. And at least now
and then
the word body positivity exists, because when we were growing up, it didn't exist.
Yeah,
you were either Kate Moss or you were.
Our mothers would
Bridget
all have been of a similar generation, yeah, as well. And I'm sure we've all
far
got
more
our own,
fucked,
like,
up. Yeah.
But also, every single relative, yeah, was allowed to tell you, you're not allowed that, you'll be fat.
Yeah.
Or you're not. And this is like, as very small children, it's that thing rather than the body positivity. I hope that children aren't spoken to about food.
Yeah, I think the parenting debate about food has massively
good and bad,
changed, yeah, and, definitely, and, yeah, and in terms of what's healthy for a child and what, yeah, you should, how you should get them to eat, like,
and eat away your sadness,
yeah, oh God. Katie, love, I want you, yeah, to, I think you should write 250 stanzas on that. That'd
but
be
then
amazing.
Also, I was saying to someone yesterday, I was like, is it possible to do that though and say it's not me? Like, could you ever have like a character saying all this? Yeah.
I mean, I feel like she's doing that. Yeah, I feel like we're getting the version of, yeah, Maggie that she wants.
If Ricky Gervais,
you know,
can go on Netflix and do a show with transphobic jokes and then say it's the character of Ricky Gervais. And I'm not saying you can't, because
you know
he has.
I always forget to compare our careers, and you're absolutely right to say that, because I always forget that's an option. You're right. I think there is a way of doing it. Sort of go,
oh, Gervais and Wicks. I mean, it's hard to tell them apart. Very similar.
Is, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's an insult to her, really, to think you could achieve this, because
it's
not a lifetime of reading and learning.
Inspired. I think, yeah, you know, I think she'd like that.
Also, it's short. Oh my God, can you imagine?
Right, it's like
pages.
Yeah.
Changed my life.
Katie, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was
fascinating conversation.
What a delightful morning.
So
I
nice.
Wish we could just carry on.
I know,
it's so nice.
I'm going to say something so sickly, but this is why I love reading. And reading can sometimes be quite a lonely experience,
yes,
or it can be a wonderful experience where it feels like, you know, the writer is talking to you, and that's the chat. But if the writer is talking to you, and then you get to talk to other people as well,
yeah,
isn't it,
yeah,
nice?
Yeah.
Especially with a book like this, where you can, yeah, be a bit like, oh, I'm not sure what she meant by that.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, totally. it's
because it can be read so many different ways.
You can pick up any page, yeah, in, yeah, an hour's discussion. Yeah. I was sort of thinking out on the way here. I was thinking, there's all. It's my head feels empty, because, yeah, it's like when she says, you know, a light so bright it's dark.
Yes,
it's like,
yes.
This is like the book. It's like, it's so bright. I go,
yeah,
I'm blank.
As we end, I demand that Joni Mitchell's blue fades, yeah, up.
I want to just read this.
Oh, yes.
The line. Nice. So Simone, I'm going to pronounce her name, Veil. Simone Veil.
I think it's
Vile.
Yeah. Simone Veil warned otherwise. Love is not consolation, she wrote. It is light. And then her very last line, Maggie Nelson, spoiler. When I was alive, I aimed to be a student, not of longing, but of light. I think that's so wonderful. And I think that's really positive.
It's, yeah, really positive.
And that's, you're not in love with longing. Yeah. You're in love with what you were longing for.
Yeah.
Thoroughly recommend it. Blew it.
Yeah.
Blew it.
Yeah.
Or blew it.
Yeah.
It's a really unusual
enjoy
book,
it,
I think.
Yeah. Enjoy it in your blue hour at the pub. have a glass of, what's it, Caraco? People used to drink.
Oh,
do you know what I mean? A
couple of bluebirds.
Caruco. What's it called?
The blue.
That all your parents would have left in the
house. WKD.
That's more modern, yeah. A blue WKD. And listen to the song, I'm Blue Double D Double D.
Thank you for listening to the Weirdos Book Club.
Next week's book guest is it's You Are Not Alone by Carrie Ad Lloyd.
Live from Foyles. Sarah's novel Weirdo and my book You Are Not Alone are both available now. And
I've got a live event coming up myself at the South Bank Centre in May. And it's on sale now.
Thank you for reading with us.
We like reading with you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hi, I'm Lucy Beaumont.
And guess what? I'm Sam Campbell.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy our podcast. It's called Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.
We have a podcast and it might be, I probably don't want to sound, you know, like I'm bragging, but it's dynamite. It is electric. It's high voltage. And please, we really need you to listen. You don't understand how much we need this.
Is it on all the platforms?
Oh, it absolutely is. But this one's out now. Lucy and Sam's Perfect Brains.